You're listening to How India's Economy Works, hosted by journalist and author Pooja Mehra.
Let's start the series with Kashmir's economy. It's right on top of the map of India and has just gone through very significant changes since 2019, when Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that gave it special powers was abrogated. This is a good time to take stock of what's going on and how the economy may have changed. My curiosity about Kashmir's economy dates back to 2010. A story I did in 2010 that was called Five Kashmiris the World Should Know is one of my most favorite assignments from my reporting years. I wanted to break the monotony of my regular reporting, and on impulse asked my editor if he'd like me to do something different, say profile Kashmir's economy. He said, yes, take along a photographer, you're going to a picturesque place. So our senior most photographer and I went to Kashmir, where we met Kashmiri entrepreneurs that had found a way to do business in the midst of political chaos, bare minimum infrastructure, security threats, stone belting, hartal, curfews, all of which were part of everyday life there. We visited a dairy plant in Pulwama's industrial growth center at Lasipura. We met a software engineer who had quit his job in the US to set up Musky Software in Srinagar. We met a woman who farmed, processed and exported lavender and other aromatic herbs. Then after a gap of 10 years, I met all of these entrepreneurs all over again on my next visit to Kashmir in 2019. Coincidentally, this was just weeks before Article 370 was abrogated. I found disappointment had replaced the excitement of 2010. A young Kashmiri entrepreneur from one of the valley's most influential business families who had talked about plans of setting up a natural spring water plant to challenge the French Evian now said that he had given up. I found that Kashmiri businesses were fed up of waiting for things to improve and were expanding their businesses in places like Bangalore and Dubai. After the abrogation a few weeks later, former finance minister of Jammu and Kashmir, Dr. Haseeb Rabu, told me that the only people who are doing jihad in Kashmir are the entrepreneurs and businessmen. He said that they have to fight for the most basic things. The biggest challenge of doing business, he said, is the lack of a peaceful environment, and that makes every business unviable there. Dr. Drabu is a professional economist who used to be a senior editor in Business Standard. He worked with the 10th Finance Commission and in the ADB, the Asian Development Bank. And he very graciously agreed to come on this podcast and discuss Kashmir's economy right from before independence and partition to 3 years after abrogation now. Let me just say that this chat will probably challenge every impression you've had about Kashmir's economy so far. Dr. Drabu, thank you so much for taking out time for this podcast. I want to talk to you about the very significant development in Kashmir's economy, where a company that you mentor has just received a proposal for foreign investment. But before I come to that, so that my listeners can understand the significance of what has happened, I want you to take us through how the Kashmir economy was structured, what it was like, right, you know, at the time of independence and partition, and then the various political developments that happened over the years and how that shaped, helped structure the Kashmir economy, and so that, you know, we'd be in a better position to understand the developments in 2019 and where things stand today.
Sure. Before we come to 1947, one of the interesting things about the Kashmir economy in particular is that it became an economy post a corporate transaction. So this is perhaps the first economy in the world which became an economy post a corporate transaction. So the East India Company sells Kashmir in 1846 after it faces a crisis in West Bengal, in Calcutta, and there is pressure on the balance sheet. The first asset monetization they do is to sell Kashmir to Maharaja Gulab Singh for 75 lakh rupees, actually $250,000 sterling. And that has a huge impact on the economy in terms of how the resources are mobilized, what happens to taxation, what happens to import prices, what happens to exports. So the biggest jolt comes into that. So the disruption in the Kashmir economy actually starts with a transaction. And strangely, there has never been a corporate in J&K ever except for J&K Bank in 1996. So 1947, the economy is pretty much driven by what I think is perhaps, again, the only place in the world where you had massive, massive restructuring of the assets, debt markets, credit markets, in 1948 through a Land Reforms Act called the Big Estates Abolition Act, 1948. And these were the most radical land reforms anywhere in the world outside a communist regime. Even Kerala does it in 1956. JNK does it in 1948. But like much else, it's never recognized. It's not a part of the economic history of India that here is a democratically elected government and it enforces land sealing. It does land restructuring completely. Not only does it kind of do land restructuring, it redistributes land to the tiller and completely alters the debt market. It does an 80% waiver, 50% waiver of the principal, no interest, makes settlements with money lenders, private money markets. So the economy is really shaken out of its slumber, so to say. And this is driven by a document which starts in 1944, somewhere around 1944, perhaps 43, 44, called Naya Kashmir, which was written by a set of communists who were working in JNK, in particular by a couple called BPL Bedi and Frida Bedi. This is Kabir Bedi's father, who was a communist activist working in Kashmir, and his Austrian wife, Frida Bedi. They were responsible for drafting the document. And it was kind of became the NAC policy of the National Conference, which that time was a party led the freedom struggle of JNK from the feudal setup. So 1948, a feudal economy gets transformed into a less feudal economy, which is altering the modes of production, the land distribution.
What is the main source of employment for the people? What largest percentage of workforce?
So even then, as of now, it's agriculture. But what happened post-land reforms, a lot of landlords, zamindars, tried to avoid the ceiling by converting agricultural land into horticulture, which is where the horticultural thing starts in JNK. It becomes a major player because a lot of apples, peaches, plums, pears, but horticulture in general, commercial agriculture. So once you had a land ceiling on subsistence agriculture, which is basically paddy and largely paddy, a lot of landlords converted their paddy fields into horticulture. That has a huge set of implications which can come separately, but it's triggered off the entire thing on horticulture. And today, as in when you look at it in terms of, you know, last 20 years, JNK has been the sixth largest producer of apples in the world on its own. India is the fifth largest, and 90% of India's apple production comes from Kashmir. So on a standalone basis, it's the sixth largest economy in the world, and there's no other production or any other variable where I think Kashmir will qualify to be in the first top 10 in the world. Prior to that, in 1948, there was a huge craft segment, the artisanal economy of JNK, which was really into handicrafts, and it has a history of handicrafts, which is largely drawn from Central Asia because that's where most of the activities used to the silk route.
Pashmina and carpets is what you're talking about?
No, I'm not. Pashmina is a very small segment, but shawls, yes, not a Pashmina entirely. That was the high-end segment, but there are ruffle shawls and there are wool shawls, and then there is, you know, embroidery of different kinds. There are rugs, which is there. So a whole range, paper mache is a huge industry there. So a wide diversified range of crafts in Kashmir. And the special thing about that being that while elsewhere you see crafts are more or less decorative, but in Kashmir, crafts are functional. So every piece of handicraft that you actually get is used. It's not put on a wall, you know. So either a carpet or a shawl, it's all a very, very functional kind of thing. And it all draws from Central Asia, Iran, the kind of designs and whatever else. So that's one large part. Since we're also on the spice route, there was a lot of trade which is happening in spices, saffron being a huge commercial crop that actually drove feudalism in JNK. Kosambi has a very nice, interesting chapter in his book on how a single crop can drive trade and commerce. So we did do some trade in spices. There were some tobaccos grown. It was, again, exported at that point of time. So largely, if you were to look at it, it was an agrarian economy which had a strong trade segment till the mid-70s, which is when the horticulture becomes big because of markets. The markets start expanding. Apple gets a good commercial return. And that's when the apple thing becomes very important. So then it becomes, and by mid-70s, you begin to see that J&K doesn't have a poverty issue because of land reforms. It's a very egalitarian. And the economy gets structured largely in terms of an export-oriented economy. So you have apples are exported, you have crafts are exported, you have tourism, which is kind of coming from outside. And it's an import-dependent economy. So it's export-oriented, import-dependent economy, which gives it a very, very different nature of policymaking required. Plus, of course, one shouldn't forget that by in the initial stage of 50s, then somewhere around the mid-60s, there was public investment, autonomous public investment, which also drove some infrastructure, be it in terms of roads, in terms of... But the size and scale of that was not very large. Instead, what grew large from government side, from public expenditure side, was government jobs. So you had 4.5 million people working in government on a total base of about 1.3 crore. So this is perhaps as big as, you know, what Bihar would have or what UP would have in terms of it. So a huge amount of government employment, which created a certain structural dissonance in the economy.
That was the political requirement, would you say?
It was, you know, corruption as a mode of cohesion, if you want to call it that. You know, you were kind of spending money on various things. There was a particular regime, very notoriously known as the Bakshi regime between, I think, 1953 and 57, when much of this happens. And then it becomes a part of the DNA of policymaking, as it were, in J&K. But what is also interesting to see is that if you map the growth of J&K economy in terms of incomes and whatever, it never really follows the national pattern. So when the national economy is doing a dip, J&K still does very well. And when the national economy is doing very well, J&K still maintains the quote-unquote Raj Krishna's Hindu rate of growth of about 3.5-4%. So, you know, it never aligns. It's not asymmetric with the national growth, largely because of the structure of the economy. So that's where it led that the boom really comes in 1970s with apples becoming significant part and getting a market price, which was very different. Plus the export markets for crafts opening up, Europe opening up big time, getting lots of stuff. So that was the boom period, the mid-70s. And that led to an enormous amount of construction in the system. And then the economy took off in a direction which few have understood.
And Government of India's policy in those years of heavy public investments, large PSUs, does that play a role in Kashmir's economy or Kashmir remains isolated from that?
Strangely, never, actually. Quite strange that there was no heavy public investment. Not that I would advocate it also, but I think there was one small little HMT watch factory, which was a part of the public investment. But one didn't see huge PSUs, one didn't see a large amount of public investment. As I said, we saw a lot of public expenditure, not public investment. I mean, one way would be, which I would tend to subscribe, is that there is no need to get into big, large public or private corporate investments in J&K. The economy should be, and pretty, we can say this now that we are in a different regime of ESG and sustainability and growth, you perhaps could think that's a good thing that happened, that there was not much of public investment, because the economy still can be resurrected through a different set of means, like the both whether it's crafts or whether it is horticulture, both are ESG compliant. Sustainability is the big thing there. So you could consider redesign the J&K economy as India's potentially biggest ESG economy among the states, because no other state has this kind of a structure which actually naturally aids ESG. And also the fact that, you know, when you look at other economies, you have to introduce policy instruments for redistribution, which you don't have to do in J&K, because the craft segment is so dissipated and diversified and, you know, distributed across the state that income distribution is almost natural. So in the case of apples as well.
So 1991, the Indian economy undergoes a big change the years that follow. Did that have any influence in Kashmir? And am I jumping too soon to 1991? Is there something that we need to talk about?
No, you're right. I mean, the big landmark was 1991 for the rest of the country when you liberalize. But the tragedy is that that's when militancy was at its peak in J&K. So 89, the militancy started in J&K, and it would be impossible to look at it from any other perspective than that. And that actually was the lost decade in J&K, which is where, you know, till then the income, per capita income was almost as much as the rest of the country. In fact, in many cases, higher. All the numbers, if you look at it from 90s, even today, 2015, 2017, every single number of J&K economy has been better than national average. Whether it is, you know, in terms of average age, income, childbirth, life expectancy at work. All social indicators are much better, largely because of land reforms. Poverty levels are 1/5 of what it nationally is there. But because of the peculiar structure, it couldn't get into a self-sustaining mode of growth. In the 90s, we missed the bus, so to say, for liberalization. Nobody would want to invest in that situation. Security was the biggest concern. There was huge expenditures happening, which caused a lot of distortions in the economy, including an asset price bubble. So you would see land as expensive in Kashmir, probably as expensive in Bombay. You know, so the kind of distortion in the asset markets was phenomenal, because there was a lot of money being pushed in for security, for all kinds of stuff, and it was finding its thing into land and other assets. Also, there were no other avenues for investment. So the long and short answer is yes, we did not get the benefits of economic liberalization. It was not the priority at that time. It was the throes of a civil strife and, you know, militant violence. So we tend to look at 90s as a lost decade.
I remember I had come to Kashmir in 2009. And I had met a few entrepreneurs there and written about them. And what they had told me is that they were very willing. These were local Kashmiri entrepreneurs. They were very willing and ready for big investments. For instance, the dairy sector, the hospitality sector, cement manufacturing, etc. And they were being encouraged by the government of India to create an atmosphere of corporate investments led economic change in Kashmir. But 10 years later, in April 2019, I visited the same set of Kashmiri entrepreneurs again. And they said that in the 10 years, all those plants that they had, some of them had set up those factories in Bangalore or moved those business plans to Dubai. And they were yet again being encouraged to relook at their investment plans. But I didn't see the kind of excitement that I had in 2009.
So 2009, I was working with the government of J&K. I had a dual role. I was economic advisor to the government of J&K and chairman of the J&K Bank. So we did some interesting work in 2008, 2009 from the bank side. We funded a lot of local entrepreneurs who today are doing very well in the state. Primarily, you know, hospitality was a big area. Something like Hyber Hotel is something we funded that time. A young entrepreneur. So I was betting on the young. So I had these 7 young kids who had just come out because there was this upward social mobility. People had moved from being contractors to large projects, send their kids abroad. They'd come back with degrees from good colleges, good universities, and were trying to kind of move up the business thing as well. So somebody's father was a contractor on the Salal project, became an independent power producer. It was a delightful experience to kind of see that transition happen. All young people, they're doing very well right now. They've diversified, they've gone into it, but purely local. Where the disappointment came, and since I had worked outside of J&K for many, many years, I personally met all the big corporates, took delegations. There was absolutely no response. You know, there was no appetite for investments even then, and even I can say that even now. In fact, even for what used to be amazing was J&K Bank was a listed stock, and we had 47%. Foreign investors, we didn't have domestic mutual funds. You know, so there was this unstated kind of a mental block against me. And that's in every sphere that I look at it. For instance, even into the research, when I was talking to you earlier about the kind of fabulous land reform that took place, no Indian academic has done substantial work on it. When you have tomes and tomes and tomes of stuff written on Kerala and West Bengal, but nobody has acknowledged the kind of significance of land reforms in India. And that phase, or Panchayati Raj for that matter, we started in 1930s.
You know, some of the entrepreneurs that I'd met in 2009 told me that, you know, they were facing a lot of problem finding the right local Kashmiri youth trained to do the jobs that required to be done. For instance, they said the Kashmir University has a course in finance MBA, which is not a, you know, other than J&K Bank, which is not a great source of employment for the Kashmir economy, but they do not have a course in horticulture, for instance, which is probably more relevant for Kashmir's economy.
Absolutely right. I mean, this is something that I used to shout from rooftops, that why am I not having an MBA in horticulture, and why don't I have MBA courses in craft management? In fact, as J&K Bank, we funded courses and chairs in the thing saying, no, we'll fund a professor in horticulture management, then that's precisely the kind of activity that should have happened. Because, you know, if you have a vibrant horticultural sector, if you have a vibrant tourism sector, if you have a vibrant craft sector, then let's look at building skill sets within those enterprises rather than doing MBA in IT and finance, which really wasn't something that was there. It eventually perhaps may come there, but as of now, if 70% of your entire activity is around these three or four things, or 80%, then why not have that kind of skills built into it? Absolutely right. But that's aside the other problem. What I'm also saying is that for some reason, Indian capital corporates never reached out to J&K. I mean, I can't think of... But you also, if you broaden it and look at J&K economy as such, we had policies, industrial policy, which gave land for 99 years lease. And Jammu did develop a couple of industrial estates where you had corporates like Videocon and others who had come in to do assembly and avail of some of the taxation benefits. Post-GST also, we still have a 9%, the SGST is refunded by the state, and so is 42% of the CGST. So there are things, but as always, the infrastructure has been so poor that it's impossible to function a good industrial unit because power still is an issue, electricity still is a huge issue, connectivity is a huge issue. So it will be difficult to drive industrialization through tax incentives.
And popular impression is that there wasn't permission for corporates from outside the state to buy land or operate. I remember you told me sometime back that none of those restrictions
Absolutely.
Were...
1929, the Maharaja issues an order which allows clause 3 of that is very clear that any corporate doing any development activity, land, I mean, forget 1929. Even in 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, 2000, you had industrial policy which gave land on lease for 99 years. So where was the issue? How did Chenab Textile Mill set up its shop in 1964? Still one of the largest employers in J&K. How did Oberoi chain of hotels come to J&K? I mean, if there was a restriction on land, how were these guys doing it? Because there was always a provision within the industrial policy, not just land, taxation, exceed capital, capital subsidy, all kinds. In fact, I remember when I was finance minister, I presented to the cabinet a note which showed that for 25 years, the amount of subsidy that the government of J&K plus government of India gave to industry was less than the total industrial output. Quite apart from being an accounting anomaly, it's also ridiculous to say that I spent 100 crores in trying to get investment and I got 80 crores, you know?
You said less, but I think you told me earlier too that the amount of subsidy was more than the output.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. 100 crores of subsidy, 80 crores was the output. So, I mean, I might have done a DBT and been done with it, right? Why was I kind of spending this kind of money? So, that also reflects the kind of anomaly. I mean, cement plants, yes, because we have a buoyant cement industry in J&K, largely it is resource-based. So there is raw material available and limestone, high-quality limestone is available. But the consequences of that on the ecology and economy of J&K have been quite damaging. So ideally, one would want a reset, which is more in line with today's thinking globally than what it was in the 70s and maybe the 50s.
The political leaders, both in the state and at the center, and the promise of the economy of Kashmir was not enough to change corporate mindsets in the rest of India to invest in Kashmir, is what you're saying.
I have personal experience on this. I've taken all the industry leaders to J&K from the IT space, from other areas. There was very little interest in, perhaps the scale was too small for the big guys, I don't know. But also there was this whole issue that, you know, it's a part of Kashmir, India, but not a part of India. So somewhere there was that whole issue of the disputed, quote-unquote, disputed tag on J&K till such time. Perhaps that was one reason why thing. But I've never been able to understand the reluctance of corporate India to invest in J&K.
And did 2019, August, did anything change after that?
I have a slightly more granular view on it. I mean, perception-wise, yes. I mean, obviously, you've created a perception that it's been integrated. It was integrated in 1956, really speaking. And by 1961, Nehru makes a statement. So does the Home Minister of India at that point of time. say that, you know, 370 is, for all practical purposes, over. But yes, Article 35A, and then the splitting of the state into two parts, then having downgraded to a union territory. What it did was create a perception. But, and I keep reading that investment is coming. I haven't seen anything on the ground as of now. But there is one thing for sure, that the environment, the day-to-day environment, not the policy environment, the day-to-day environment, operationally speaking, is far better. You don't have stone pelting. You don't have hartals. So you have an auto driver who is sure that I have taken an auto on a loan, I'll be able to do my day's job and pay my EMI. So there is that security without doubt, which is there. I was in Srinagar a week back. You can see that it's far more stable. So a guy doesn't have to worry that if I had to go to my orchard, will I get, you know, stoned in the middle, or will there be a hartal? No. So that stability, which is the providing an overall environment, not policy environment, but pure operational environment to function, is certainly way better than it has been in the last 10 years.
And what about the disputed tag, which was such a big cause for reluctance?
I think that for sure has dissipated, and the kind of media and civil society and government actions post-abrogation of 370 should not leave anybody in doubt in terms of the status of J&K. So, you know, my point has been that, not that there was it earlier, to the perception that, you know, you were looking at it from a different perspective, from innocent purposes. And in fact, just before I was dropped from the cabinet, I had a big session with foreign investors and domestic investors in Delhi, where I in fact said that, you know, there is no legal restriction to your coming. And whatever else we are seeing are more on the social side, not really on the political side. But post-abrogation, that part should have settled the thing. But I still don't see people investing. Again, at the end of the day, you go back to the basics of why would you want to invest? I mean, yes, there is a certain national requirement perhaps, but fundamentally businesses are driven by profitability. And if you have poor infrastructure, if you don't have state investing in infrastructure, which is critical infrastructure, then would investments flow to J&K? So perhaps I had signed an MOU with Dubai World to do a dry port because our connectivity is very, very poor. But that didn't again materialize. So somewhere we are not seeing that quantum investment which will lift the state.
This is the constraint that the valley faces because it's landlocked and the only access to it is through the highway or the airport, and the highway tends to get blocked. Is that what you're referring to?
Even so, well, that's been a major improvement in the highway connectivity also. We also have another road now. The train has reached. So there is that connectivity that's happening. But within the industrial estates itself, intrastate, interstate, yes, connectivity is poor. Obviously, we're landlocked. We need to look at some of these mass initiatives like a dry port and some of that, plus information for products and all that. It's not a fully functional, robust economy where there is, asymmetric information is huge there. So that's where you're really talking about the constraints on investment. The situation should look better, but we keep hearing, I don't have any information on actual what is there, but we keep hearing investments have come, 30,000 crores, 40,000 crores, 50,000 crores, but I haven't seen a quantum thing that, look, this has now come up and this is a major initiative. In fact, Jammu also, which has a large SME sector, has not been doing too well in the last couple of years. Of course, COVID must have had a huge impact itself. But I don't see the thing. But I'm also in some ways happy because if that investment comes into the areas like steel, cement and whatever, then perhaps would not be in the long-term interest. So one needs to reset the thing to look at it from the perspective of sustainable investments, new energy sources. We have a huge potential of geothermal, this huge hydro potential, which are new age kind of sectors. Perhaps a focus on that would be ideal.
Spring water and tourism, of course.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, a whole lot of stuff. Food, I mean, the kind of food that you can perhaps, if a master chef can transform Australia's tourism business, I'm sure something similar would be very transformative in J&K. But what I find most remarkable, and I've not been able to, kind of get my head around it, is visually speaking, the number of shops that Kashmir has per capita must be the highest in the world. For every 2 feet, you have a shop. So, you know, that whole tertiary trade is just booming, and I can't figure out how that has happened. So many years back, I had written a piece called The Economy of Kashmir is about makan, because everybody constructs houses, huge ones, dukan, and wazwar. These are the three things that wazwar, of course, the feast. So I said, this economy is driven by these three things. So you have huge construction, which has big spin-offs in terms of, you know, employment generation, labor, material intensity is very high, so you get multiplier incomes. The problem is that since most of it is imported, the multiplier gets active outside of JNK and not within the JNK. And that is quite tragic, because if you're able to capture the missing multiplier, as it were, like, you know, Kashmiris are known to consume mutton. The entire thing comes from Rajasthan. Chicken comes from Punjab. So the multiplier effects benefit those states are then in this case. But again, I saw a lot of problems. That was one of the reasons why we did that, was to, you know, sign off on GST, because that time we had the right, we had our own constitution. We could have very easily done it under our own act. But because we are a consuming state, GST tends to benefit that. So the resources are much better now. It is not like the earlier regime where production states would benefit. So you find that we are getting a lot of tax incomes, which would probably strengthen our own resource base. And we also need to realign that. I remember when I first went in, we were taxing exports, Apple exports. And it was like quite bizarre. Why are you taxing the most? So we withdrew that tax. We bought in we abolished the octroi on apples and stuff. So that also led to a certain generation of income within the state.
So politically and security-wise, issues are largely settled, you're saying. If the infrastructure problem could be resolved, do you think there'll be more corporate interest in Kashmir from the rest of India and probably rest of the world?
For sure, political insecurity should have been now addressed. If you were to ask me, do I want corporate investments? Can we first corporatize these sectors? So the problem really is that you have a horticulture sector which is informal, which is unorganized, which is still functioning in the same way in which it functioned in the 1940s. You have a forwarding agent, you have a mandi in Delhi, you will send fruit, then you have no control over it. It gets, you know, there is a glut at a particular point of time. There are no storage. But what has happened over the last 10, 15 years is a huge amount of investment in agriculture infrastructure, horticulture, largely private, not government. All CA stores have come, so you store apples. Earlier, my father himself is an orchardist. All his life, he used to send his apples to Delhi in a store. Now, there was prior issues of cost and all that on it. You had no control over it. But now that there are those storages which have come, CA stores in JNK, you can store in JNK, so the multiplier also gets addressed there. You can exit at will. You can store it till January, avoid the gluts, get better price realization. So we need to strengthen the sectors that are vibrant and growing, rather than chase the sectors which are not there. So if you were to look at horticulture, you can start doing risk mitigation by doing futures and options in the markets. You can do information technology based, you know, addressals on that, on disease patterns, on management of pesticides, fertilizer, water conservation, and also corporatize the entire formation of an orchard. Now, all orchards in JNK, to my mind, now are anywhere above 80 years old. So they're not going to have the same yield. So when you look at our yields, despite the fact that we are the sixth largest in such a small area, our yield is 10 to 15 tons per hectare. The global average is 40. You go from 10 to 20, you have sorted the problem of JNK forever. You know, so that's where the just is so simple that I don't know why one has not been able to actually convert this into a very operational policy. So if you create, you know, small branding units, you create packaging units. I had started an initiative called Apple Village, which the government was kind of giving 50% subsidy and saying you convert to high density, which is still there. You convert this into high density and we'll give you for 5 villages, 6 villages, 1 branding unit and some of that. So it becomes more like a gentleman farmer. So you go, you know, you can have an MBA in horticulture who runs your farm and stuff like that. So you will then see once that is there, then corporate interests will come in. You know, so that Because you will see an established form. You look at a balance sheet. You look at what is my EBITDA, what is my PAT, what is my... You look at the normal kind of stuff that happens in any enterprise. And then you can look at investors and say, look, this is my thing. These are returns I give. I have fabulous returns, 25 to 40%. Why don't you invest? Now, we are doing it the other way around. I mean, but that's not how it ought to be. So that's the broad thrust of what I've been saying for a few years.
For our end, I want you to tell us about this company you're mentoring and its founder. Foreign investors, and probably how it encourages the rest of young investors in Kashmir.
Yeah, as I said, during the phase of when I was in the bank, we had put together a bunch of seven young kids who've done, one was in hospitality, one was in power, one was in horticulture, one was in spices. So we had this bunch of youngsters. That's the investment that really has happened over the last 10, 15 years and has fructified. So you can see some of those investments are very much flourishing. So one of those was with horticulture. It's a young gentleman from Shopian who set up his orchard installation company. So, and he installs high density orchards and has a CS store. It's a more an integrated unit, does a bit of IT in terms of trying to provide diagnostics to various farmers. And he's already working with 10,000 farmers. He has converted a whole lot of orchards into high-density orchards. So it's become one of his drivers of thing. So, and not really in terms of any government support, but generally working on the private sector funded by the J&K Bank and so on. So he reached a certain scale when it was looking that one should try with not just debt, but also explore the options of private equity. You're not really yet for public markets, so you're looking at private markets. And he reached out to quite a few funds across. It was a very difficult job because, again, the due diligence requires such a thing which a startup doesn't have. So all of that was quite long and arduous. But Incofin, which is, I think, a Danish impact fund, did invest 60 crores, value the company at around 400 crores, which is wonderful because, you know, it just sets off a different thing in J&K. First of all, gives a huge confidence to every orchardist that this is something I can do. Do asset monetization, raise private equity, raise growth capital, grow bigger, you know. And also more important for me was not so much that the money came. Yes, that's very, very critical. But what will it do to the enterprise? You know, you'll get into governance, you'll get into a board, you will start looking at various options, risk mitigation. So you will evolve as a company. Now, as a policymaker, my whole effort would be to let these companies evolve from being in school to being in the university and college and then go, right? So you'll start up in the school because you don't have all companies in J&K are stunted around 400-500 crore, you know. So it hasn't reached the second level. The only listed company out of J&K is J&K Bank. So the point being that the one more Jumbo company, which at some point I'd helped out, did list in the smaller exchange, has done very well. Given 1200% returns, Sarveshwar. You know, so there are these pockets of good excellence which need to be tracked. And since they're not in public markets, private equity. So I think you will now see there have been some small private equity investments in logistics space in Kashmir. I see some 10, 12 crores, but this was a large ticket trend into horticulture. So a fabulous development which should open up this whole area and perhaps bypass some of this whole fetish that we have with corporates. If you see these funds and there are, you know, now a whole lot of private equity players who are investing so much in the rest of the country can invest in these businesses, that perhaps is the route to follow. And then subsequently, they will handhold them to the next level where perhaps the exit option could be a listing in 5 years from now, 7 years from now, who knows. So we are quite delighted to see that happen and absolutely wonderful for Puram, who has done a great job in setting this up, has pretty much employs 2,000 people. And has been there on the field for 15, 16 years now.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Wishing all the Kashmiri entrepreneurs and the Kashmir economy all the best.
Thanks, Pooja. Wonderful speaking to you. Thank you.
Kashmir's economy, like much else, there remains a bit of a mystery. Just like business groups from the rest of India shrink from doing business in the valley, professional economists have not paid enough attention to the Kashmir economy. Someone should study it, so that we don't fall back on oversimplified explanations like money inflows from across the border, which may well be true, but can it fully explain Kashmir's prosperity relative to the rest of the country? Perhaps the land reforms, as Dr. Drabu said, ought to be studied for their impact on inequality. Before I sign off, let me add that not all episodes of this series will be on states or cities. Also, that if you're curious about the political context post-1947 that Dr. Thrabo refers to many times in this conversation, let me recommend a book that I happen to be reading and which I suppose helped me keep pace with what he was saying, especially about many of the political personalities he mentioned. This book is called Sheikh Abdullah, The Caged Lion of Kashmir. Its author is Chitralekha Zutshi, a professor of history that has written many books on Kashmir.
You've been listening to How India's Economy Works, hosted by journalist and author Pooja Mehra. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter at www.thecore.in. That is www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback, so do write to us at feedback@thecore.in. Thank you for listening.